So that, in other words, really, the only dividing line, really, you were saying in that answer, really, between the burglary and the murder, again, this is not a subtle way to say that there was a murder of a dissenter in this country, because I don't have any evidence of that effect at all. But the point is, just the dividing line is that, in fact, the dividing line is the president's judgment.
Yes, and the dividing line, and just so that one does not get the impression that a president can run amok in this country and get away with it, we have to have in mind that a president has to come up before the electorate. We also have to have in mind that a president has to get appropriations from the Congress. We have to have in mind, for example, that as far as the CIA's covert operations are concerned, as far as the FBI's covert operations are concerned, through the years, they have been disclosed on a very, very limited basis to trusted members of Congress. I don't know whether it can be done today or not.
Right. But on the other hand, I don't
and
think...
And that's a restraint.
Yes. I don't think, reading the documentation, that it was ever intended, was it, that the Houston plan and the black bag robbery should be revealed to the electorate or really discussed with Congress?
No, these were not. That's correct.
The war at home continued, as did the unwelcome leaks of information, which led to one of the most curious chapters of Richard Nixon's presidency. It involved the creation of the White House Special Investigations Unit, more commonly known as the Plumbers. The original purpose of the Plumbers was to plug unauthorized White House news leaks, but their activities expanded and resulted in another clause in the Articles of Impeachment. Mr. Nixon has acknowledged that the unit was established at his personal direction following publication of the Pentagon Papers in the New York Times in June 1971, leaked to the Times by Daniel Ellsberg. Despite Ellsberg's public admission of responsibility and subsequent indictment, the Plumbers still began to look for any information that would discredit him politically. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy were both recruited to the Plumbers unit, which reported to John Ehrlichman, one of the president's two top aides. Dissatisfied with the results of a psychological profile, Hunt, Liddy, and a team of Cubans were dispatched to Los Angeles, where on September 3, 1971, they broke into the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist, Dr. Lewis Fielding, in a search for material damaging to Ellsberg. What exactly was the sequence of events, in the sense that We know Ehrlichman talked in broad terms to you beforehand, and afterwards he got filled in, and then he had meetings with you. What is your recollection of that sequence of events?
I don't recall the specific sequence of events. You may recall I was rather busy at the time.
In the actual period before the Fielding break-in, in August, I think Mr. Ehrlichman has said that he talked to you about the fact that Hunt and Liddy had to go operational, had to go to California to find information. How much did he tell you at that time?
I do not recall a conversation with Ehrlichman on that. I know that he has said that. I know also, however, that he has testified that he did not authorize or know of the break-in until afterwards, when he severely condemned Krogh and reprimanded him for doing it. Now we have a situation where the question is whether Ehrlichman informed me that these two men were going to California. He may well have. And if he had, I would have said, go right ahead. But I recall no conversation whatever with Ehrlichman about their going to California for the purpose of what was called a, quote, covert operation, or for the purpose of determining whether Ellsberg's psychiatrist might furnish information. I have no recollection whatever of that.
And after the event, when he got filled in on the fact that they'd done the job and found very little in this
nothing.
Illegal break-in, nothing.
Dry hole.
Did he, what did he tell you about it afterwards?
Nothing that I can recall. I have no recollection whatever, having been told anything about it afterwards.
But and bearing in mind that the tapes and all that are in a sort of legal limbo at the moment, and that you were very busy at this period, would you say that if the tapes of this period of August before the break-in and September after the break-in were ever to become public, is it just as you forgot for a while some of the content of the June 23rd conversation, would you say it's 100% impossible that those tapes would ever show there was any discussion like this between you and Ehrlichman over the Fielding break-in? Or is it possible that, in fact, there could have been such a conversation, and as you say, you quite genuinely don't recollect it?
Let me say that I would never say that it was impossible. I can only say that I am basing my recollection on what others who perhaps did not have as many things on their mind as I did at that particular time have said. I've talked to Bud Krogh in recent months. He said he is totally confident that I was not informed before or afterwards. Ehrlichman has testified that I was not informed before or after. We're talking about the Fielding break-in now.
Right.
And September. I'm basing my recollection on that.
What about the proposal to do the firebombing at the Brookings Institution? As you know, there is word to the effect that that was something that, on one tape or another, which I have not heard, that you actually specifically asked for that. Not the firebombing necessarily, but asked for the Brookings Institution to be covertly investigated.
I have no recollection of authorizing a break-in at Brookings. I, however, would not say that I did not express great concern about the fact that Brookings might have this, and that I did not express a very great interest in trying to obtain those documents from Brookings, get them back in some way if we possibly could. But here again, when you say you haven't heard the tape, I haven't heard it either, the tape that you refer to. And so we're now in the hearsay area. As far as I was concerned, however, let me say that if I had evidence that Brookings did have him, if I had evidence that somebody at Brookings was going to put something out, I would have taken very strong methods to get them back.
Now, we have the situation where we have the plumbers dealing with, as you say, with leaks or with people who considered to be dangerous to the administration in one way or another, etc., and doing these various activities that we've been mentioning. Also, at the same time, there were enemies lists circulating and conversations about the use of the IRS and all of that, also moving against opponents of the administration. In the September the 15th tape, for instance, Haldeman says that Dean's moving ruthlessly on the investigation of the McGovern people and working the thing through the IRS, and Schultz has been a bit difficult, and you say, I don't want George Schultz to ever raise the question because it put me in the position of having to throw him out of the office. He didn't get to be Secretary of the Treasury because he had nice blue eyes. It was a goddamn favour to get him that job, and so on. And then you talk about using the IRS, and you say, I want the most comprehensive notes on all of those who've tried to do us in, because they didn't have to do it. They're asking for it. They're going to get it. We haven't used the Bureau and the Justice Department yet, but things are going to change now. Now, was that another part of the same war that you were waging with the plumbers?
That's an entirely different matter. The point is that when an agency is asked by a president or anybody else to do something that it has a responsibility to do, that's not illegal for them to do it or for it to be ordered, even if the motivation is political. But it's in my opinion, it's wrong. It's bad. But let's get away from this hypocrisy where we have a situation of saying, well, it's all right if you're going after as far as IRS returns, it's all right to go into H.L. Hunt, and as Robert Kennedy did, ordering IRS investigations of 17 right-wing organizations in order to get their tax exemptions removed. It's all right to do that, but it's wrong when you go the other way.
But as we look at the overall picture and those things about the comprehensive notes on those who've tried to do us in and all of that, and talking in that same conversation about Edward Bennett Williams, and Haldeman says, that's a guy we've got to ruin. And you say, yes, I think we're going to fix the SOB.
Yeah.
Believe me, we're going to, and so on. Isn't there in that whole conversation
A paranoiac attitude?
Yes.
Yeah, I know. I understand that. And it gets back to the statement that I made, rather emotional statement, the day I left office. And I said, don't hate other people because hatred destroys yourself. Yeah, I want to say here that I have a temper. I control it publicly rather well. Sometimes privately I blow off some steam. But also, as I've indicated, and this is very hard for people to believe, but I think you can believe it after our session a few hours ago. My weaknesses is perhaps where personal factors are concerned. Let's take the Kennedys now. Did you know that in 8 years, after Mrs. Nixon and I had served in Washington for 8 years as vice president, I was vice president, she is my wife, we were never invited to the White House, to a dinner or to a lunch. I remember Rosemary Woods, my secretary, who made up the invitation list, went out of her mind when I put Hubert Humphrey on the list for White House dinners. When I put, for example, invited Jackie Kennedy and her two children to come up for a private dinner without any publicity so that they could see where their father had, where they had grown up and all the rest. When Mrs. Nixon had Rose Kennedy over. Okay, that takes care of that. What I'm trying to tell you that this whole business of am I paranoid about hating people and trying to do them in? And the answer is, at times, yes, I get angry at people. But in human terms, as far as I'm concerned, I believe that an individual must never let hatred rule him. Dolores Hope, Bob Hope's wonderful wife, once said something to me when we first came to California after the resignation. She said, remember, Dick, she said, one person who loves you is worth 10 who hate you. And so there's a love-hate complex in all of us. And I just hope that when they tote them all up before you go to St. Peter's or the other way down, that maybe the ledger's going to come out reasonably well in that respect.
You said, in fact, in one of your speeches about taking responsibility for the climate in the White House and so on. And when you were talking about just then about we have people who are for us and against us, I just remembered from somewhere a memo of Bud Krogh's where he said, those who are against us we will destroy. In fact, those who are not for us will destroy or something. There was this sort of extreme atmosphere abroad, this extreme climate abroad.
Let me tell you this. That atmosphere, however, has to be understood in the context of the times. This nation was at war. Men were dying. The people that got us into the war, the brightest and the best, proved to be the worst in this crisis because they could, like Ruskin Rostow, at least have either supported or given us a chance to get out of the war that they'd gotten us into. But on the other hand, they turned totally around. And they stirred up the demonstrators. They couldn't possibly, in my view, intelligent as they are, have not understood that this kind of activity, the divisiveness in America, was making it very difficult for us to convince the North Vietnamese that they ought to negotiate. Now, that's why Henry Kissinger, when you talk about this whole matter of leaks and so forth, and people think that maybe Kissinger went a little overboard at times on it. Or that I did. But I'll never forget when the Cambodian leak occurred. And we said, Henry, it's possible it might be somebody on your staff. And Henry said, I will destroy them. Now, Henry's not a mean man. I mean, he's not one that would, after, you know, his background, knowing what the horrors of a really repressive state, Hitler's Germany, who's going to do that, but he says, I will destroy them. Why do we feel this way? We felt this way because the people on the other side were hypocritical, they were sanctimonious, and they were not serving the best interests of the country. This is why I must say Henry and I felt so strongly about it. And call it paranoia, but paranoia for peace isn't that bad. I don't mean by that to suggest that everybody that was out talking against the war deliberately, with intent, was prolonging the war. But the effect of what they did was to prolong the war. Had it not been for the division in America, the war would have been ended 1 to 2 years earlier, in my opinion.
But what you said...
And basically, what Ellsberg really boils down to, I mean, the discrediting and all the rest, what it boils down to, I didn't want to discredit the man as an individual. I couldn't care less about the punk. I wanted to discredit that kind of activity, which was despicable and damaging to the national interest.
Pulling some of our discussions together, as it were, speaking of the presidency in an interrogatory filed with the Church Committee, you stated, quote, "It's quite obvious that there are certain inherently governmental activities which, if undertaken by the sovereign in protection of the interests of the nation's security, are lawful, but which, if undertaken by private persons, are not." What at root did you have in mind there?
What I at root I had in mind, I think, was perhaps much better stated by Lincoln during the war between the states. Lincoln said, and I think I can remember the quote almost exactly, he said, "Actions which otherwise would be unconstitutional could become lawful if undertaken for the purpose of preserving the Constitution and the nation." Now, that's the kind of action I'm referring to. Of course, in Lincoln's case, it was the survival of the Union. In wartime, it's the defense of the nation, and who knows, perhaps the survival of the nation.
But there was no comparison, was there, between the situation you faced and the situation Lincoln faced, for instance?
This nation was torn apart in an ideological way by the war in Vietnam. As much as the Civil War tore apart the nation when Lincoln was president. No, it's true that we didn't have the North and South
fighting
each other. 13
states weren't seceding and there wasn't fighting.
I understand,
in that sense.
I understand. We didn't have the North and South fighting each other. And what I was saying, it was torn apart, ideological speaking. I mean, you were there at the time. I mean, nobody can know what it means for a president to be sitting in that White House working late at night, as I often did, and to have hundreds of thousands of demonstrators around charging through the streets. No one can know how a president feels when he realizes that his efforts to bring peace, to bring our men home, to bring our POWs home, to stop the killing, to build peace not just for our time, but for time to come, is being jeopardized by individuals who have a different point of view as to how things can be done. Now, that's how I felt about it.
Yes. But when you said, as you said when we were talking about the Houston plan, you know, if the president orders it, that makes it legal, as it were, that is the president in that sense, is there anything in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights that suggests the president is that far of a sovereign, that far above the law?
No, there isn't. There's nothing specific that the Constitution contemplates in that respect. I haven't read every word, every jot and every tittle, but I do know this, that it has been, however, argued that as far as a president is concerned, that in wartime, a president does have certain extraordinary powers which would make acts that would otherwise be unlawful lawful if undertaken for the purpose of preserving the nation and the Constitution, which is essential for the rights we're all talking about.
But why not act in order not to endanger the system through the system, through Congress?
That's a possibility which, of course, certainly occurred to me. It was a situation, however, where in the temper of those times, to move through the Congress would have probably been an impossibility.
Looking back, if the Vietnam War had not gone on throughout your presidency, there would probably have been much less domestic discord. The unifying policies that you adopted at the beginning might not have led to an atmosphere of polarization. And many of the so-called abuses of power might never have occurred or come to light or been necessary. In that sense, someone has said, I wonder if you agree, that in that sense, perhaps, you were the last American casualty of the Vietnam War.
A case could be made for that, yes. There isn't any question but that in the conduct of the war, I made enemies who were, from an ideological standpoint, virtually, paranoid, I guess. The major newspaper publisher and told Henry Kissinger one night right after the peace settlement, I hate the sons of bitches' gut. And naturally, this is coming right after the time that we had been able to have the peace settlement, is an indication of how deep those passions ran. Because that kind of attitude developed over a period of years. I mean, my political career goes over many, many years, but the actions, and many of them I took with great reluctance, but recognizing I had to do what was right, the actions that I took in Vietnam, one, to try to win an honorable peace abroad, and two, to keep the peace at home, because keeping the peace at home, keeping support for the war, was essential in order to get the enemy to negotiate. And that was, of course, not easy to do in view of the dissent and so forth that we had. And so it could be said that I was one of the casualties, or maybe the last casualty in Vietnam. If so, I'm glad I'm the last one.